This talk was given by Vanessa Zuise Goddard Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Zuise Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order and the work supervisor at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Ahora contaremos 12. Y nos quedamos todos quietos. Por una vez sobre la tierra no hablemos en ningún idioma. Por un segundo detengámonos, no movamos tanto los brazos. Sería un minuto fragante, sin prisa, sin locomotoras. Todos estaríamos juntos en una inquietud instantánea. Los pescadores del mar frío no harían daño a las ballenas y el trabajador de la sal miraría sus manos rotas. Los que preparan guerras verdes, guerras de gas, guerras de fuego, victorias sin sobrevivientes, se pondrían un traje puro y andarían con sus hermanos por la sombra, sin hacer nada. No se confunda lo que quiero con la inacción definitiva. La vida es solo lo que se hace. No quiero nada con la muerte. Si no pudimos ser unánimes, moviendo tanto nuestras vidas, tal vez no hacer nada una vez, tal vez un gran silencio puede interrumpir esta tristeza, este no entendernos jamás y amenazarnos con la muerte. Tal vez la tierra nos enseñe cuánto todo parece muerto y luego todo estaba vivo. Ahora contaré hasta 12 y tú te callas y me voy. Well, good morning, welcome to this retreat on silence. I normally open with an invocation by Shantideva, and it's an invocation of wisdom and clarity and compassion, the wish to realize myself for the benefit of all beings, the benefit of everyone. And this time I decided to start with this poem by Neruda instead. And I knew that if I read it in Spanish, some of you would not understand it. Some of you might understand just perhaps some of it, but that at least for some of you, it would just be words, it would just be sounds without meaning, and that what you would be left with would be the listening itself. And it's not unlike the Dharani that we chant. So this morning we chanted the Shosaimyo Kichijo Dharani. It's a healing chant, it's a protective chant to protect and dispel, protect from and dispel disasters. And the Dharani, although they are, technically they do have translations, they're not meant to be translated. And so we chant them, the chant that we do is really a Japanese transliteration of the Sanskrit, and it really is meant as a chant of sound. Syllables that are thought to have a certain power, in this case, a healing and a protective power. There's the residents during Ango also chanted the Dahishin Dharani in the evening, in the afternoon. We do that during Sesshin. It's a chant of compassion. And Kukai, who's the founder of Shingon Buddhism, said that Dharani and mantra are related in that every syllable of a Dharani is the true manifestation of reality, that the sound itself is manifesting the true nature of reality. And I actually think this is true of any sound, any syllable, and yet we are chanting certain sounds instead of others. And this is not just in Buddhism, this is in Hinduism. There's you know, they're not called Dharani, but there's such a thing in Christianity and Judaism. So I think we all understand that from fundamentally, there is something that happens with sound, and of course its relationship with silence, that has certain sounds have a certain strength, a certain power to them. And what is that? Like, where is that? Where does that live, that power? And, you know, Neruda's poems are not Dharani, strictly speaking, But I think they go a long way towards expressing, in fact, the true nature of things. And his use of Spanish was such that it's kind of a bummer to translate them. Even good translations don't really convey what he was doing with the language in Spanish. So I am going to read it again, this time in English, because in this case the meaning is relevant to us today. But I would still encourage you, let it move through you. You know, Daidoroshi always wanted us, you know, when we were giving an instruction on how to listen to the Dharma talk, Dharma discourse that we do at the end of the week, he would always say that it's radiant to the dark to the mind, but radiant to the heart, which really meant don't try to sit there and understand it intellectually. There is something else that is happening. And we would often say, you know, that it's a Buddha speaking to a Buddha. We would say, you know, listen to it if it's you're the only person in the room. You're the one that this is being spoken for, which is, of course, true. And so listen to it in this way again. See if you can let your mind remain still and let the words do what they do so well. And so the title is Keeping Quiet, and it's from the book Estravagario. And I really looked. It's an untranslatable word, but it's. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, it has a mixture of something that is extravagant, out of the ordinary, but it's also a vagary. Vagary is also you know, kind of like a wandering. And it has this connotation of also something very ordinary. So this is keeping quiet. Now we will count to 12 and we will be still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be a fragrant moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his broken hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on pure clothes and would walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with definite inactivity. Life is what we do. I want nothing with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a great silence might interrupt this sadness, this never understanding ourselves and threatening death. Perhaps the earth can teach us as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count to 12, and you keep quiet, and I'll go. And I am well aware of the awkwardness, really, the irony of having a retreat, of spending a day speaking about silence. But I also feel strongly that's ever more pressing to speak about it, to bring it to mind, to raise its presence, to highlight it, and definitely to protect it. And primarily, well, both because it's increasingly rare, but also a question that I've been reflecting on for some time, and that is, why is it that if we are so attracted to silence, and some of us are, certainly if you do any kind of meditative practice, there's an aspect of you that is drawn to it, that is called to it. Of course, you are here, you know, doing this retreat, spending the weekend in this way. So if we are drawn to it, why do we so often create its opposite? why do we so sometimes enthusiastically break it? And by break it, I mean, break it. I mean, create a rift in its continuity. I think many of us understand that it's a very natural state of being. Certainly when we look at the world, we look at the natural world, we can feel, we can sense the presence of silence. And if we're not afraid of it, we are drawn to it. But then why is it so difficult for us to actually rest in it, as I was saying this morning? So let that not be a rhetorical question. Let me actually ask you right now, why do you think that is? And just practically speaking, do we have mics, Liam? Okay. So practically speaking, if you could raise your hand and then wait for the mic to get to you, because we are recording so that people can who will listen to this can hear you as well. And let me just say, just before we begin, because I remembered, you know, those of you who, well, all of you are probably aware. So Wesley, the slightly older gentleman who came for this weekend, you know, we had a couple of interactions with him, and it became clear that he wasn't feeling well and that he actually needed medical care. So Shoan and Roxanne took him to the hospital in Kingston, and they hope to join us later today. But just so you know that he's fine, but we felt he needed a little more attention, and so that's where they are. Okay. Yes, Liam, what were you going to say? Oh, yes, so if you could lift the mic so he knows what color to activate, and when you're holding it, hold it close to your mouth so we can really hear you. So the question is, you know, why do we long for silence and so often create its exact opposite? And another way to enter this question is would be to say, you know, what is your relationship with silence? Yes, Greg.
I think for me, it's the conditioning of language. I'm used to relating to the world, understanding the world through my language, specifically verbal language, so words. So when I experience something, those words pop up and I feel reacted to express in those same words. I think if it was just pictures as opposed to words, mm-hmm. silence might be a little easier or easier to come by.
You mean if we communicated pictorially instead of through language?
Yeah, the words tend to encourage the talking. As I think them, so too I want to express them.
So you're saying it's a form of communication, really, relationship. Okay. Gail.
For me, I think it's fear, you know, almost like an infant in a crib who's crying and nobody hears them, or, you know, there's no response to it, or that you're just all alone. I mean, that's an image that comes to mind, just great fear of that, what it feels like to be in that silent place.
And so if you take that a little bit further, because I think it's a very common fear, I think we have all experienced it at some point. What is the fear of? I am afraid in that moment, there's no response, let's say. What is the fear? I am afraid of?
You know, I'm not totally sure, but I think maybe it has something to do with being totally alone, abandoned.
I'm afraid of being abandoned.
Yeah.
I'm afraid of being
There's
alone.
There's no one out there. You know, you're just... Yeah, I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but I can't... That's what comes to mind, just that being abandoned and being alone and disappearing in a way.
I'm afraid of disappearing. So remember these. So I'm afraid of being abandoned. I'm afraid of disappearing. I'm afraid of being alone. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maria Jose?
My relationship with silence is that I find it very comforting. There's a discomfort in it, but I find that discomfort comforting.
What's the discomfort?
I think the opposing, in a way, the what's expected of us to fill the space with words or actions.
And who expects that?
I think we're just taught that. I think children are very comfortable being quiet, like playing without speaking or just staring or, relating without having to use words. And somehow we learn to fill that space.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that in relating to people, more often than not, I find other people are beginning conversations or saying something or asking questions to not be in that space where, I don't know if it's fear of the emptiness or not knowing what's going to happen, or I'm not sure.
So let me go back and press you a little bit. So what you said, it's true that we learn often to fill silence. But the first thing you said is we are taught, right, in a sense, to fill that silence. So who are the agents, who are the people teaching us these things?
I think in going to school, like, you're very deliberately taught to communicate with others.
So your teachers in school?
And parents and parents. I guess adults.
Okay.
As you're growing up.
And the reason I'm trying to make that specific, so it's not this kind of abstract passive voice, is because we do very much act in the way that we are taught and the examples that we have. So if you grew up in a home where silence was comfortable, was a valid way of relating with one another, then your experience of silence would be very different. If, you know, your parents or your peers, your siblings, for example, were uncomfortable, and what you were learning, the message that you were getting from them, the message that they were teaching you, knowingly or unknowingly, it doesn't mean they necessarily wanted to, but they did. That is what they communicated. Silence is scary. Silence is not safe. Silence is not good. Then that is, of course, what you internalize and what becomes part of your experience. But it's not, I think what I'm stressing is that it doesn't happen abstractly. It's not mysterious, really, when you start to look at it. There's certain very clear messages that someone is giving you and that you then take in. And that's how your relationship then begins to be, in this case with silence, begins to be built. Right? Kristen, you had your hand up first, or? It's okay? Okay, so somebody.
I think the longer that I work with silence, the more I realize that it's, for me anyway, it's about sort of the discomfort of understanding that the storyline that you tell yourself all the time is not really all that solid. And there's a discomfort in that. I mean, there's a comfort in it, but there's also sort of shakes your whole reality a little bit.
So if it's not solid, What's under it? What's the truth then?
It's a really good question.
In one sense, is it the question? Well, it's certainly the question underlying our stories, right? How do we form our sense of self? Is by creating, and don't get me wrong, some of you know I love stories. And so there's nothing, I don't feel there's anything wrong with stories. However, stories is how we, the way that I understand it, the way that I see it, is the stories are how we understand ourselves, how we understand the world, how we shape and give order, make sense of our reality. As from the perspective of Buddhist practice, for example, it is beginning to investigate what that story is. You know, someone said to me that the purpose of psychotherapy is to replace a faulty story, an unhealthy story, with a healthy one. The purpose of Buddhism is to show you don't need a story, actually. But we'll come back, because you can't just throw away the stories. The fact is, this, once again, this is how we understand ourselves and how we relate to one another. But there is this moment, certainly, if you practice any form of meditation, if you spend any time in silence, there is a moment of, uh-oh, maybe this is not what I thought it was. Maybe this is not as solid as I thought it was. And then what? Who else had their hand up? Carolyn or Ikea? Venus, did you have your hand up? Okay.
Hello. I equate my silence with my solitude. And I've, through the years where I always had to have friends, we had to be doing something, I've done quite the reverse. I like my solitude, and I equate that with my silence. I can sit around people in a coffee shop and still have my solitude and my silence. I can be walking in the forest, and it's not that it's silent. I'm loving the silence of all the sounds. Then I think, is this carrying everything a bit too far because I like being alone? But I don't know, but I do treasure my silence.
What do you mean too far? Like, what's the line, and who decides where it is?
I'm not sure who decides, but I've noticed sometimes we used to go out a lot in the evening, say to the theater or something, and now I want to sit at home and have a fire. Mm-hmm. And that's the quiet. I still remember the first time I turned the radio.
Do you feel bad that that's what you want?
No. Okay. But I think I should. I don't know.
Well, right there.
Okay.
Let's not lose that opportunity. So you think you should want to go to the theater. Whose voice is that?
I think it's a voice from another time that's saying, oh, you should go out and enjoy the theater. You should be out. And I'm is it winding down?
So you're saying it's your own voice,
yeah.
But from another time?
From another time.
Okay.
Also, I remember the first time I turned the radio off in the car. That was so exciting. I rarely have anything going on in the car. I don't need it. So, yeah, I like silence.
Yes, and that's really important because we all operate under these lists, these weights, these piles of shoulds, you know, if they're unexamined. And what you said is critical. We are changing beings. We're developing beings, and of course, hopefully, we are getting older. Hopefully, we're maturing also as we're getting older, and things change. But there is something, and certainly there's something. There's messages that we get in our culture, pretty much all the time, that are moving us in a certain direction, and that create a particular storyline. Like maybe there is something wrong, or is it, maybe it is pushing it too far. Maybe you're becoming a loner and you're not going to want to socialize with anyone. You know, even if you were to take that, you know, to its logical conclusion in your mind, first of all, is it really true? But let's say that it was. Let's say that you reach a point where you just don't want to go out anymore. So what? Whose life is it, you know, after all? There is a lot of stigma, I would say, or a lot of pushback, certainly against silence and solitude, right? Like if you're eating in a restaurant by yourself in this culture, in Mexico, you just don't do that. I mean, that's just weird. You don't go. I don't think I know anybody who would ever go to the movies by themselves in Mexico. I think I know people do it a little bit more. And I have a friend who said he loves going to the movies. And he said he really had to be careful at a certain point because people thought he was weird. You know, if he went to watch an animated movie, he said there would be like an island around him because all the families would steer clear of him. So that is how strong, you know, our fear of that solitude and that solitude which you brought up can be sometimes justifiable, very often not. I think, Elizabeth, you've had that mic for a while. Go ahead.
I actually...
White.
I actually was going to make a little bit of the same point as Gail, which is that I find the stories that I tell myself inside, that sort of noise is really comforting still. Like, I'm rewriting the past or, like, projecting into the future. And I know that they're not really comforting, but they still feel comforting to me. It's very hard to let go of that. And that's, I think, a little bit what stops me sitting sometimes, is that I know that on this path, that's part of what I'll be letting go of. And it feels like such a big part of me that I'm terrified of not being able to rewrite my life in my head.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's powerful to be in control of your own story, of course. It feels like completely yielding your power to do so. And that is why, I often speak of, that moment in Zazen where you're beginning to feel, you're really at that edge of really letting go, of, as Master Dogen says, dropping off body and mind. And you can usually sense it because everything gets very quiet, right? And for, I would probably say, 10 out of 10 people, at least the first time that happens, it's terrifying and something will happen. Your body will jerk. Or you just start telling stories, inane stories. You start singing songs. Oh, you recognize that. So it's from the perspective of the self, as I've said many times, from Suisse's perspective, letting go is not a good idea at all. I mean, what is it? It's death. It's extinction. So Gail was saying, one of the fears is Gail, right? No, not Shoshin. Yeah, you said it. Fear of disappearing. That is a real fear that we have. And that is why it requires, as a practitioner, and probably not just in Buddhism, as a spiritual practitioner, it requires getting to the edge of that cliff enough times that you, out of either desperation, out of a trust that you didn't even know you had, you take that next step. You have no idea where you're going to land. But if you're practicing, some part of you knows you will land somewhere because there's no place where there is no ground. We speak of groundlessness in Buddhism, but that really is another way of saying there is no place where there's no ground. So some part of you knows enough. Also, some part of you is hopefully looking around and saying, well, other people seem to have done this, and they're still here, so something must be working. And at some point, even despite yourself, you take that next step, and you realize, oh, that fear was not what I thought. That the fear of dissolution and of disappearing is not what I thought. Venus.
I want to speak to the aspect of it that has to do with always talking and not really the silence part. I feel like for myself, especially like I come from New York City, I live in Manhattan, life is just fast-paced all the time. I think that with being able to communicate, you find yourself in those moments where you could pull yourself away from the pain or you can make yourself feel more pleasurable. So you're kind of like tricking yourself almost by verbally making yourself seem okay, but not really facing the silence of knowing that everything actually is okay. So I think the constant need to speak is just masking it all and trying to avoid finding that middle ground that is not so pleasurable or not so fearful, and it just is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I recently read a quote by a painter who said, sound imposes a narrative on you, and it's always someone else's narrative. I mean, even when it's your narrative, it's someone else's narrative. It's kind of like you standing back apart from yourself, narrating your own life to yourself. And he said, my experience of silence is like being awake inside a dream I can direct. And it's interesting that he's saying that he can still direct the dream. We would say you don't need to worry about that. You don't need actually to direct it. The dream takes care of itself. And so once again, it returns, and we'll be coming back to this throughout the day, to the trust, a deep trust, and courage, for sure. You have to be fearless in order to truly be willing to enter into silence. And that's why, you know, to me, the most powerful kind of silence is not the silence that is imposed. So here, we practice a fair amount of silence. From this to this time, we're not going to speak. We say, okay, don't talk to yourself. We do a week out of every month where we're saying we're in silence. And that's very powerful. It's practicing noble silence, as the Buddha called it. But I feel that the silence that we seek, the silence that sometimes finds us when we're unawares, is the most powerful, the most transformative. Because it is when we want to be in that stream that true transformation can happen. When we're tired of that stream of thought, you know, it's become so loud we can't even hear ourselves, we can't feel ourselves. So we have to be willing to look for some other way, right? We have to be willing to be still, to listen. Gandhi called it the still small voice of God, really. But, and I was saying to one of you earlier, in my experience, that I call it my voice. And in my experience, it has never been wrong. And I see it really as the voice of wisdom, the part of me that does want, in fact, to be awake, that does know what it is that I need to do that. That voice has never been wrong. I have often been wrong when I try to argue with it, when it's an inconvenient time in my life to do what the voice is saying I should be doing. Perhaps I'm not ready. Perhaps it's too frightening or too unsettling. But that voice has never been wrong. And in the beginning, it's just a whisper. That's why you have to be still and silent to hear it. But at least my voice just keeps getting, if I don't listen to it, it just keeps getting louder and louder and louder until I reach a point where it is all I can hear. And that's when I realize, okay, enough. I need to do something about this. So I've been learning over the years how to not wait until it's screaming in my mind, you know, until I can't ignore it, but to actually be listening right from the beginning. Sometimes I'm still not ready or I'm not able to shift, because usually what it requires is some kind of change that is either uncomfortable or frightening. But at least I'm more willing. It's like, okay, this is telling me, all right, let me turn my attention to it. And when the time is right, when I am ready, I will shift. And it's also, you know, I think the voice, I read a quote, and he was a South African, I believe he was in the military, Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, and he advocated for 2 minutes of silence. This was after, I think it was World War II, and he advocated for 2 minutes of silence. He had experienced that in South Africa, and then he was in Great Britain. And they found it so powerful that they started broadcasting it, right? And so at a certain point, it was to celebrate Armistice Day, they would broadcast 2 minutes of silence. Really, something so simple, which we have now many times experienced, you know, when something large enough happens, you know, in a more global scale, you know, a way to recognize, let's not just brush this aside. Let's not just hurry past this. This actually requires that we stop and we turn our attention to it. And it's also, he was the one who said, you know, that being in silence reminds you that you are great, that you are vast and universal, that there is much more that is happening than just what is happening in my life, my story. It doesn't exclude it. Once again, it's not about erasing myself in order to experience that vastness. It's a matter of understanding who I'm much larger, that what I'm most of the time able to see right here, right here, right here, right here, what I'm able to narrate to myself. Barbara, do you have a... Yeah. Didn't you want a mic? No? Okay. Go for it.
Long time ago.
Call the mic close.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody ever heard this. I'm a little bit older. Cat got your tongue? My relatives used to say that because up until sixth grade, I didn't say anything. And I went into a sixth grade classroom where I had a very comfortable, safe surrounding, and...
Do you remember why you didn't want to speak?
It just seemed to be so much going on. I was the fourth child. Everybody was busy. I just kind of was confused, followed everybody around, dragged here, dragged there. I didn't feel like even I had an identity yet. Everything was for the older siblings. You know how you're just kind of went with the... I just went with the show. Mm-hmm. I didn't cause problems. I was quiet. My brother did all the complaining, and it was so much screaming from him. I just kind of was like, okay, I was good. So the sixth grade, I developed what they called a quick wit. All of a sudden, things popped out of my mouth, and I was like, who said that? You know, and after that, I never shut up. So, because I got attention, you know, not the kind where, where is she? Just grab her and bring her. You know, I was put, you know, it was different. But then when I got married,
maybe you were just storing it up. You were, like, building it up all those years.
But then when I got married, my now ex shamed me again.
For speaking.
For joking. You're not funny. Shut up. Nobody wants to hear you. That was what I was hearing. Mm-hmm. So I stopped again. But the ironic thing is that he's the one that talked me into coming here. And when I started to sit... my fear started to be realized, because that's when you start to face your discomfort. You know you're not happy. It starts to get louder. That voice gets louder and louder until it's screaming at you, just like what you said. And I realized I had to make a shift, and I had to make a change that I did not want to do. I was Catholic. You do not get divorced in the Catholic Church. And I realized I was in an intolerable situation. The situation was taken care of for me. He ran away. So I didn't have to do it, but it was to the point where I was breaking down. Mm-hmm. And so the pattern continues. Now I'm still talking. But again, silence is very important, because when I was a counselor, you had to learn how to use it. Because there's nothing more difficult than being a new counselor and being silent when you're in a room working with somebody, because silence has to be used sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, so who do you think was the true Barbara? So the one who didn't speak for those 6 years, or the one who discovered she had this quick wit?
All of them. Because I love silence. I catch myself talking and I say, you know something? I talked enough. But I need to listen now. You know, I use all of those things. And I still don't really know who I am. I think that they're all pieces, facets, all the things I've studied. Existentialism, we're all faceted. I mean, how many sides do we have? A million? You know, I don't know. So I'm still trying to figure it out, because I really don't know who I am. I don't know if I was still at home, being quiet, the sixth grade kid that got witty, the woman that was told to shut up. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've discovered. I don't know anything. So
it's a good perspective from which to approach certainly spiritual practice. I don't know. Yeah. Janet.
My relationship with speech, with speaking to people, is more from the place that it's required of me by others. That being very quiet was a preference of mine, and it made members of my family uncomfortable when I would not give them my verbal attention, when I would not participate in things that they were doing. I really feel sometimes like when somebody wants my attention, they're treating me like some sort of gumball machine. They, mm-hmm. You know, they tap me and they want me to say something so that they don't feel afraid or they don't feel alone. And my own experience of speaking, when I do speak, it's been sort of an act of courage for me. I'm very, you know, it's a way of proving to myself that I'm not afraid of others, that I can allow people to be in my life, that I can't allow myself to be, you know, one of this giant pool of humanity as opposed to the person sitting in the corner by herself quietly. So, there's this kind of phobia of speech and a certain impatience when I'm being asked to speak, and I am speaking now. But I you know, I'm very comfortable with the little narrative in my head, and the practice of Zazen for me is about quieting, you know, bringing about that complete and total silence within myself. Because if you have a practice of being a really shy person, a very social person, that voice in my head is kind of the loudest voice most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's a question that I wanted to bring up. And, you know, I often do this. I often end up asking questions. So if you have questions as we go along, please do ask. But I just find it boring if I just sit here talking. But do feel free to ask. But what I was going to bring up is, so you brought up Zazen. What is Zazen really? Like, there's all these thoughts, right, that come, and you're given a practice, counting your breath, following your breath, being your breath, let's say. And all of these thoughts will come as you're trying to do this. What do you do with them? Right? So I'm trying to see, how do you understand what it is that you're doing in Zazen? What are you doing, basically, is what I'm asking. Anybody? Okay, inhabiting emptiness. You have your hand for a while up. Yeah.
This was actually related to before.
That's all right. We can return to that.
I just wanted to say that, I grew up in a family that didn't communicate very well, and since I was a very small child, So I was used to silence, but it was not the right silence, and so... I went to nature already as a very little.
What do you mean it wasn't the right silence?
It was. It just didn't feel right because it didn't give me answers to questions I had about people's behavior. And so I didn't know where to go. So I went to nature, and nature has become for me this refuge and that place of silence. That's also filled, and I still have that. And right now, it's hard for me actually to sit in a room with many people and meditate because there's still this kind of expectation that we should be communicating, or it relates to the lack of communication when I was a child. But when I go to nature, it's so easy for me to just sit. So I think even when I was very young, I already trained myself kind of to meditate on my own in silence, in nature. But now I have this conflict that it's hard for me to sit with people and be silent. But as soon as I go like into the desert or the mountains or even here in the woods, it's like I immediately connect, and it feels like this natural state that you said before.
And what are you doing? So as a child, I'm sure you hadn't received beginning instruction in Zazen. So what were you doing?
I just sat on the ground and I would just stare at the leaves and the bugs and just look at them, look at my surroundings, and kind of, I guess, disappear there in a way.
And you're not doing that anymore in your Zazen?
No, that's very... Well, if I'm on the cushion with others, or even at home, it's different. But when I go into nature, it's like a habit. I just sit there and I feel very present. But it feels like I'm not following the instructions.
So why don't you try tonight when we do Zazen, why don't you just sit there on your cushion Just do what you do when you're in nature. Don't worry about the other people in the room. They'll do whatever it is that they're doing. What if you just sit there? No, I'm serious. Because what you're pointing to is absolutely true. This is the natural state of mind. You know, the countless teachers are really, especially Tibetan Buddhist teachers, are hammering that point. The mind is naturally quiet. And by that, it doesn't mean that there are no thoughts, but it's quiet, it is stable, it is still, it is clear, it is luminous, it is vast. Why doesn't it feel that way most of the time? Because there's so much that we cram into it. And so it is very much a process of returning to that natural state. It's not always going to feel that way, of course, because there is effort. The fact is there are a number of people in the room, there are things happening, you know, you're not making that up. However, I wonder if there's an added layer of now I'm doing something different than what I was doing when I'm sitting in nature, and I'm saying you don't have to do that. It is so just experiment. Just see what happens if you enter your zazen with the same ease, if you will, that you do when you're out in the desert. Just sit there and see what happens. Chris?
I was thinking something from the mm-hmm. conversation like 20 minutes ago, but thinking about zazen, something just struck me as an answer perhaps to both for myself is that I think it's a Sanskrit, or comes from Sanskrit, neti neti, not this, not that. Mm. And I think of zazen as continual attempts by the stories of my life to identify a subject and an object. You know, like, this is true about me, this is true about the world. This is true about me, this is true about the world. And in zazen, if I don't get hooked, if I don't answer those questions, if I just let the questions be, it's a process of being neither this nor that. And if I keep doing that, like not answering the questions, like not solidifying and not reifying things, it becomes like what it is if there is no subject and object. Mm-hmm. You know, if things aren't reified and Trungpa used to say solidified, you know, don't make things mm-hmm. so solid. Mm-hmm. And that's always felt like when I am wrapped up in subject and object thought, like the whole universe becomes kind of like, I always think of like white kind celluloid plastic. It's just like kind of like, or that, you know, like industrial like nylon that they make like everything out of, you know, it's just like solid, homogenous, dull, and it's answered. Like the question's been answered. It's like, this is how it is. And there's no freedom. There's nowhere to go once mm-hmm. everything is answered. But to keep stepping back and to not answer those questions, you're still there, even though you haven't answered the questions. But what are you, you know, and what is the other if the self isn't answering any questions? It's, you know, it's like living in that question for that time.
Right. And so we're coming back to what some of you have brought up already. So who am I if I'm not speaking? Who am I if I'm not constantly talking to myself and redefining and recreating myself? Or if you're not doing that for me, who am I then?
The earlier thought I had was I enjoy going to the wilderness, like deep in the wilderness, and mm-hmm. I do it on purpose. You know, it's not like a casual camping trip. My friend's like, oh, let's go car camping. I'm like, no. Like I do it sometimes now, but I prefer to go deep into the wilderness. And a lot of it is that the first time I went to Yosemite and I was like deep, deep in the backcountry, like 20 miles from the road and hadn't seen anyone else for a day or two, and came to this big meadow, it's still one of my favorite places in the world, I felt witnessed by reality. I was just who I am. But I don't know what that is. You know, the meadow was so beautiful. You know, I came like over a little crest, and it was just there, and it was breathtaking. And I felt like I belonged, but not in a personal sense. It wasn't a sense of like, oh, now I'm away from stuff, which it was funny because that's what I've been going for, was, you know, very much to have a experience for myself away from the other that I didn't want to be with, you know, like civilization and pavement and people and everything. And that was in that moment, and for a while actually really gone, and instead there was just like witnessing, you know, that it's a quality of belonging that I can't describe, but it's super real. And my memory of that is a lot of, you know, when I get out the map every year, like this year I'm going to the North Cascades, which is gigantic as well, and there's places in there that are like, you know, no one ever, you know, the park ranger was like, no one ever goes there. And I'm like, yes, like I'm going there. it's that. It's just, and I love it. And I work on finding it elsewhere, but I also love it out there in the wilderness.
And so in that moment of having that feeling, that sense of belonging, did you really need to know who you are?
No, not at all. Like it
in a conceptual way.
Yeah, it was. It's funny when it's like it's sort of like I was untroubled, but it was more like it was untroubled as well. You know, like the subject and the object were just, there wasn't a question of being troubled or not being troubled about, yeah, what is this and who am I? It was just this beautiful, like belonging.
Well, that's exactly right. It is untroubled. We are troubled so often. It is not. And so to me, silence is one very powerful gateway into entering that space of no trouble, that space of untroubledness. Simply not because it wasn't there before, but because we forget and we need to find a way to remember, to remind ourselves. Hold on before... Ashley, or... Yes, you had your hand up before, right?
Is this working?
Yes.
So, I don't know. I see silence and quiet and more so listening as a superpower in the world we live in today. To be able to sort of listen to the silence and interpret it is a superpower. I work in nursing in New York City, in like arguably the busiest hospital in New York City. And I'm also a nursing student. And so you're kind of expected when you're in that setting every day to have something to say, to always have something to say. You're always comforting somebody and asking questions and assessing a room and multitasking all the time. So you're always moving and you're always go, 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 go. But sometimes just listening is way more powerful than words in my own experience, especially in terms of communicating with others. I worked for a few years in psychiatry, psychiatric nursing, and I think my experience with even the most acute population of patients, all they ever want is to be heard. They could be, you know, somebody could be screaming, 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 and you'll see people, even in movies, if you watch a movie and you see, I don't know, a scene in a psychiatric ward in a hospital, everybody runs over and tries to calm them down, but nobody's actually listening to what's going on and hearing the problem. So it's very, very, my point is that sometimes it's more powerful just to listen and to not always fill the space with meaningless words. And I think that creates a better understanding for everybody. Mm-hmm. And listening and quiet and silence is a superpower.
I would agree. I would agree with that. Let me... So a couple of the things that you brought up made me think. You know, one of my favorite Dogen quotes, and it's from the Mantasan River Sutra, is really just a fragment, says... It is said out of fear that without such a resting place, things would not abide. And he's referring really to what he calls small views, limited views, and that does the world rest on the wheel of wind or on the wheel of space? And Dogen is basically saying, well, it is just said out of fear that without such a resting place, things would not abide. In other words, why do they have to rest anywhere? Why does there have to be something holding things up? And think of how much of our lives is spent doing exactly that, holding ourselves up, holding our lives up, finding the kind of the props that keep us upright. And Dogen certainly practices pointing to the truth that perhaps you don't need to do that. Perhaps you don't need to work so hard. You know, even when I used the word earlier, you know, rest in silence. And the reason I use that deliberately is because our lives, for most of us, are so busy and are so hectic, and we're constantly moving and doing and propping ourselves up, that to find a place where you can, in fact, rest, when you can relax into your own being, I think is crucial. And at the same time, it's a little bit awkward to use that word because of what he's saying. You know, there is a place, a state of being, if you will, where you understand, oh, things don't actually rest anywhere. There's no need to understand what this is because this is all of it. Right? It's like constantly asking yourself, you know, am I Suisse? Am I still Suisse? Am I still Suisse? You're checking, am I Suisse? You wouldn't do that, right? You know in yourselves who you are. It's like that. It's that kind of knowing. And so to go back to Zazen, because one of the residents brought up recently, and I thought it was a good point, you know, you could say misunderstanding or the view, you know, that Zazen could be about stopping thoughts. So what do you think of that? Yes. Mike over here.
That relates to what Chris was saying, and I can't remember your name, about
Sabine,
about being in nature and phenomena in nature, and how that doing that we feel like we have to do something about things and people and thoughts. When you're in nature, and there's a tree or the wind or a bird, there's nothing to do about them. Like, they're there. Mm-hmm. They're not a subject or an object. So for me, Zazen is the state of non-doing without denying what's going on. And that's really hard for me to actually do mm-hmm. in Zazen. Mm-hmm. But when it happens, I recognize it as this kind of relationship where there's a non-doing that's, you know, like, it's not that you become the tree or that you think about the tree or admire the tree or anything. It's just, there's nothing to do about the tree. The tree's just there, and you're there.
Okay, so it's a profound non-doing.
Yeah, and in a way, it's like the most profound relationship without there being an active or passive, mm-hmm. like subject-object mm-hmm. relationship.
Mm-hmm. Okay. CJ?
The thing that I find interesting about it all is the duality that exists. You have silence and not silence, rather than, or noise, whatever you call it, the birds out there, whether it's the trucks out in New York City or, you know, whatever. And you really can't do anything about that background ambient noise that goes on. You know, and what kind of flusters me a little bit is how do we get around that duality? You know, like my own personality, I'm a very driven person. You know, I'm like my wife calls me the driving wind, and my son jokes about it and calls her the quiet ocean. You know, when we get together, we create the tempest. You know, just a big firestorm of whatever. You know, so I'm wondering in Zazen, how do you grasp that that perfect state, you know, where you're like moving from one moment to the next. I mean, I think I was kind of grasping it this morning when we were cleaning up in the Zendo, and you know, like a scrape a huge stack of pillows that were out there, the Zabutons. Mm-hmm. And I was like thinking, okay, this is cool. There's like one Zabuton right here. We're cleaning it. You know, I got the big, not worrying about the big pile in front of me, not worrying too much about that, maybe that tiny little speck of dust I left behind the three Zabutons ago that couldn't get up because I was scratching at it, whatever. But, you know, I'm only focusing on that one Zabuton. And eventually the work was done. We moved on to the next thing. You know, but how do we get that kind of focus continually? Is it just a matter of practice? Because sometimes when I just try and sit, I can't quiet myself down, you know, to that level of, you mm-hmm. know, just sitting there. I'm always fidgeting. Mm-hmm. I'm very ADHD, by the way, so that's kind of where I'm going with that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I always got some kind of fidgeting, some kind of nervous energy. It's very hard for me to dispel.
But you did it when you were cleaning.
Yes.
So the activity helps you.
I was actually having a great time doing it, believe yeah. it or not. I mean, something as mundane as vacuuming Zabutons, you know.
I love cleaning the Zendo. I'm with you.
Yeah. Or like when I don't know who I was talking to. I was telling about last week when I came here mistakenly early. You know, my friend who had right. driven me here just gets a wild idea to, let's get these logs, these ash logs that he makes syrup during the winter. And I'm just having a grand old time just helping him pull these 200-pound logs out of the bog, you know, and just throwing them in the back of the truck. You know, it's just like that simple work kind of like occupied that space. And, you know, I joked around and called it my moment of zen right there, you know, just mm-hmm. thinking back to an old TV show where they used that phrase a lot where everything was just moving in a perfect synergy, you know, and I was like...
So the question is, how do you do that when you're sitting still?
Yes.
Yes. Right. So, well, practice, first of all, but in the sutras, they break down, you could say, the process of, and I'm going to call it stilling the mind because that's how they speak of it. It has its problems, but bear with me. Allowing the mind to really return to its natural stillness. And so the first one is directed application, where you are saying, okay, I will see a thought, I will let it go, and I will come back to my breath, because the object of my meditation, the object of my awareness for the next half hour is my breath. So it is that initial, and in fact it's called initial application, that initial stating of your intent, this is where I'm putting my awareness. Then there is continuous application. So you can't do that just once, right? You have to do it moment after moment after moment. And it is very much like building, you know, your muscles. You are building the muscle of concentration. And then rapture appears. And rapture really, you know, sometimes it's described as bliss. Rapture, I see it as the reward for our effort. You know, so there's a point in your zazen in which everything does get quiet enough, and that feels good. I was saying to people who were beginning instruction last night, when your mind becomes unified, if you can get to that point, it feels good. And there is a kind of elation. And to me, I mean, it's so wonderful that's kind of built into it. It is kind of like the reward for that very concerted effort. There's also happiness. And Joseph Goldstein has a very nice way in which he distinguishes the difference between the two. He says, rapture is like the excitement and anticipation you feel when you're in the desert and you're looking at an oasis in the distance and you're anticipating, you know, there's the excitement of seeing that. And it's a very strong feeling of joy and lightness. And it, as I said, it tempers and it kind of complements the hard work of concentration. Happiness is a quieter feeling. It's more a feeling of relief. It's the feeling that you have when you arrive at the oasis. Is that kind of contentment that comes from single-minded concentration. And all of it is for the what reason? Is single-minded concentration, is merging of subject and object for the purpose of seeing yourself, for the purpose of cultivating insight, cultivating wisdom, seeing into the way things are, into the true nature of things. And so, and people often describe what you're describing, that it's easier, you know, for them to stay focused and grounded when they're moving, walking meditation, for example, being out in the woods, if you're hiking, especially long stretches. For some people, that's easy. And so it is a matter of exerting the same, well, perhaps a different kind of effort. To me, it really boils down to reminding yourself of what you really want to do, your intent. You could call it also your aspiration. If you really want to be clear, it will require that kind of stillness and that kind of concerted effort until the moment where it becomes more natural. Let's speak a little bit about the kind of the states of concentration later. So it does become easier with time, but in the beginning there is quite a bit of effort involved. And so you're speaking of really kind of relentlessly seeing the thought again. Okay, set it aside, now bring yourself back. There it is again. You let it go, you bring yourself back. And you keep doing that over and over, developing your ability to concentrate when nothing else is happening. And if you can do that, then you start to really know that you can do that anywhere. And when you're doing anything, it shouldn't be, you know, that's why when people speak of the zone, right, of flow, I think it's a very powerful state, but it's dependent on an activity. And usually it has to be a high degree of challenge and enough ability for you to meet it. So an athlete, for example, being in a state of flow, needs to have the ability, but also to be challenged. Samadhi, which we call it, is single-pointed concentration. You can cultivate samadhi when you're washing the dishes, when you're, you know, hanging your clothes, when you are cleaning a toilet or having a conversation, right? It's not dependent on the activity itself, and that's why it's so powerful. Yes, Anne.
So thinking about silence, you know, most of the time, there's sound everywhere, but there were two kinds of experiences that I had as a child that were actually very deep and powerful silence. So I grew up in the Midwest, and in fall and spring there were tornadoes. And if the tornado was close enough, in the minutes before it came down, everything stopped. The birds, the insects, the wind, everything. There's nothing quite like it. It's so quiet.
Yeah, it feels kind of supernatural almost. Right?
And we moved to the Midwest when I was three, so I started experiencing this as a very young child, and tornadoes themselves are deafeningly loud. So it almost makes the silence more powerful, because what's coming is going to be a roaring, like, I don't know, like the ocean. Mm-hmm. And the other kind of silence was much more gentle. At night, we lived in a subdivision. There was no traffic at night. And it would be in the deep cold of winter, and it would be snowing. And so sound would just, you would hear things, but then it would just get, by degrees, quieter and quieter and quieter. And somehow it was never that quiet during the day, snowing. Mm. But at night, especially when it was very cold, and interestingly, with the cold, you actually hear things farther away, but mm-hmm. the snow would kind of blanket that. And that was another kind of silence that just... I wasn't a quiet kid. I wasn't one of these kids who was happy to be quiet all the time. But those experiences of silence, it felt very tangible, like something I could just enter into and be in mm-hmm. and be surrounded by. But you can't grasp it. It's hard to even describe.
Yeah. I'd like to do a practice with you, and so just in preparation for that, and I will speak more about, you know, just the Buddhist perspective of silence, but I love the Christian mystics, and I think so many of them speak so beautifully, so eloquently about silence, and Pseudo-Dionysus says this with of really of contemplation. He says, in the practice of mystic contemplation, leave behind the senses and the operations of the intellect, and all the things that the senses or the intellect can perceive, and all the things which are not and things which are, and strain upwards in non-knowing as far as may be. And the author of The Cloud of Unknowing took this, you could say this view, and said, so between you and, in this case, God, but let's call it you and the source, this true source, the nature of things, between you and it, let there be a cloud of unknowing. And let there be a cloud of forgetting between you and things, you could say below you, and include yourself in those things and the stories and the names about those things. And so you have a cloud of unknowing above, a cloud of forgetting below. And then basically it's like every sense and every bit of you is listening itself. So you're not listening just with your ears, you're listening with your entire being. And it's a practice that requires a kind of rest and a kind of a complete openness into what is, as somebody else already said. And so the question that I have for you, because you'll actually go out and do this, is what are you listening for, right? Or what is happening in that silence as you actively listen in this way with your whole being? What do you perceive? And so what I would like to ask is that we go outside and we'll do maybe, you know, 20 minutes or so. And what I'll do is I'll ring the loud bell outside so you can hear when the time is up. So don't go too far. Also so that you're not spending most of your time traveling. If you find that moving helps you, so walking meditation, for example, it's okay to do that. Otherwise, if you can find a place to sit. But you're not doing zazen. You're not focusing on your breath. You're not counting your breath. You're really just sitting in the presence of this silence. And if you want to call it anything, that you're doing is you're listening with your whole being. And then we'll come back. Okay? Is that clear? So leave, you know, if you have notebooks, drinks, anything like that, leave that here. So it's now 11:15, so let's be back here at 11:35. So what did you experience?
Well, just to take it chronologically. So I went out and sat down, and I initially heard a bird song, then the sound of the water, and I could hear people moving around me, and then I started to notice my adrenal response to hearing the sound of voices, mm-hmm. which is a sort of like, I can feel my adrenal glands kind of like releasing a surge of energy through my body. I would sort of, I found that, you know, what are we listening for, that it's, things would just sort of come to me, you know, like the sound of the bird would capture me. And then I, at a certain point, after a few minutes, it was what captured me was the sort of sense of just being, the beingness of outside. You know, it became interesting to me that. Something that I noticed in Zazen, I sort of almost fall asleep, and there's the release of what I think of as some sort of endogenous opiate, like something in my body is released, which relaxes the part of my brain which is thinking. Mm-hmm. So the part of my brain that's thinking gets this release of some sort of opiate, stops thinking, and there's a moment of quiet, which feels very pleasant. Mm-hmm. And then I'm kind of curious about that moment, which kind of, you know, it's quite familiar to me now.
When you say that you're curious about it, in what way?
Well, it's. I suppose I'm curious, as in, it's nice, and it's almost slightly, like I was going to say, slightly addictive. Like, it's like, I'd like that to happen again. I'd like that sense of the mind stillness, mm-hmm. and yet it's me talking to myself is interrupting the very experience that I'm seeking.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. Well, you know, what CJ said earlier is a very valid point, you know, in a sense that the duality, that you know, here we are, you know, sitting here speaking about silence, and of course, in one sense, the contradiction of that. But as I was asking earlier this morning, is there a place, a view, a point from which there is, in fact, no duality? You know, there is no one listening to the sound of the bird. There's no difference between sound and silence. So you could say, you know, in this world of form that we all live in and are interacting and relating in, for the time being, we speak of sound and silence, hopefully just so that we can learn something, you know, about ourselves. But it's not the thing itself. And I think we all understand that, you know, that by speaking about silence, you know, today is not that we'll have, well, I don't know. I was going to say it's not that we'll have some profound transformation, but, you know, maybe we will. But it's really in those experiences, in those moments where something really does shift, that is, that where you go beyond that language, where you do go beyond the duality of sound and silence, where you realize, oh, there's something else. Something else is not the right word. There's something happening that a lot of the time in our experience we can't make contact with because of all the noise, because of all the bustle. You know, so this is just dipping into, you know, giving ourselves an opportunity to be still enough to... I sometimes imagine it as like I'm in this big room and there's all these glass windows. And I've walked past that room a million times and I have this vague sense that there are the windows and there's kind of something out there. I don't exactly know what. And one day I decide to stop and turn and actually look. And I realize, oh, there's a vast landscape out there that I had some sense of, but now I'm actually seeing. To me, it's like that, you know. I think we understand that there's something. Otherwise, why spend our time doing something like this practice? You know, why, of the myriad things that we could be choosing to do with our lives, why be still and quiet? There's something in us that senses that it has something to offer. And then we get, hopefully, we get these glimpses that realize, oh, okay, there is a whole, you could say, a vast universe out there. I would like to see it, in fact.
Yeah, that makes me think of the Buddhist, I think it's the Buddha who would talk about meditation as, you know, when we are letting go of certain pleasures, but we're doing it for, you know, for a higher pleasure, for a higher happiness, for something, you know, a more refined form of joy than we might receive from, you know, following our habitual noise or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and that's why the sutras and certainly the koans in the Zen literature warn against that falling in love, you know, and with that rapture, with that happiness, with that bliss. Again, I think to me it's a very kind of intelligent design that it I mean, it's kind of like sex, you know, it feels good, so it wants it compels us to do it. And so there is this aspect of these deep meditative states that, again, is blissful, you know, it feels good. But to stay there would just be recreating the pattern that we, most of us, live our lives by, which is, let me accumulate as much pleasure as I can and avoid as much pain as I can. So therefore, you know, the sutras and the teachers say, you know, it is there, you know, that bliss is there, but the whole point is to understand, to see, to realize the truth of suffering and its alleviation. That is why we would do any of this at all. That's really the bottom line. Taiju, you had your hand up earlier. I don't know if you still want to. How about this time?
Something other than several different things, but just thinking about being outside.
I just had that kind of experience that I was sitting right out that door because it was close and it was easy for me to get to. And I started, the communication I was having was with this clump of wood that I was sitting on, and I felt it in my butt. You know, that was, I was listening to different kinds of things. I was listening and feeling that when it was a very different way of looking at the side of the whole building that I've looked at for years. And now I'm seeing something different. I'm seeing winter leaving and summer coming. So like I'm getting other kinds of messages. They're not really messages. Somehow or another, the whole emotions and feelings got very tied into this. And that's what happens for me a lot. Because I get involved, I get teased about the fact that I can't just talk about something, I have to tell a story. And I guess it's probably entertaining myself and trying to get somebody else to understand what it is that I'm seeing. But it can get a little carried away. But it's like my listening was in so many different aspects of my life. All of a sudden, just sitting out there for those minutes.
And so you're bringing up, because I would really like to kind of delve into this kind of thorny issue, if you will, of thoughts and feelings. You know, so one of you was bringing up, you know, so what about feelings? You know, is zazen about, or is, you know, living your life in a clearer way, in a wiser way about not feeling? Is zazen about not thinking? What about that? What about the kind of the paradox of silence is a very natural state, and yet we do have to work. We do have to strive to actually get in touch with it and remain in it. So how do you understand all of this?
I think part of it for me is being and not going down, not making it turn into a detective story where I'm trying to find some mm-hmm. answer to something, which is very, very tempting. And it's a way of me knowing, where am I going? What am I doing here? It's about my life, what my life is. What is it? Who am I? Mm-hmm. I'm still struggling at 79 to find that out. And with aging, it's different things start to happen.
That reminds me of a story, Kathleen Norris. I don't know if you know her, the author of Cloister Walk. She was, probably still is, a Benedictine oblate. So she was attached to a couple of different communities, Benedictine communities, and just spent a lot of time practicing and writing about her spiritual path, her religious calling, really, as a lay woman. And she's a very good writer. And she tells a story that in one of the communities, the nuns, there was an older nun who had Alzheimer's, and all the other nuns were taking care of her. And so one of the nuns was going to go visit her one day. And so another one of the nuns said, that's great, just tell her who you are because she may not know. And so the other nun goes, you know, to visit her, and she greets her. And she says to her, do you know who I am? And the nun says to her, if you don't know who you are by now, I certainly can't help you because you're old enough. So just reminded me of that. So what about this? Or anything else, but what about this issue? Thoughts come. Feelings come. That is how our mind also works, how our body, our being works. So What about them? What about them in the silence? And Mark, and then Blue. Oh, and I'm sorry, Carolyn, you had the...
Oh, that's
okay. Okay, do you want to... So somebody can pass Blue a mic. We have another one, right? Another mic? Can you just pass it over to...
So that thing of feelings, like when I was out there sitting and just trying to listen and feel it all with my body, and really trying to put that intention and not thinking. And yet, there was a tinge of sadness, like when you put just a little one drop of food coloring. And it wasn't a thought of feelings, but that it's in your body. And if you're really quiet and listening, it's there. And I don't think that Zazen gets you away from that. It just sometimes makes it a little more visible.
Mm. But and what is the sadness about? Do you know?
There's a handful of things in my life that are sad.
Mm-hmm. So could it be that sometimes we don't turn to silence because it means feeling that more?
I think, yeah, there's a real avoidance of that, like a fear, but it's there anyway.
Mm-hmm. And yet it's interesting, you know, Neruda in his poem says, you know, if for once we could do nothing, perhaps that great silence, and maybe that's part of what might make a difference, perhaps a great silence might interrupt this sadness, this never understanding ourselves and threatening death. You know, so to me, he's speaking of a silence in a sense in which we come back home, in which we feel that belonging in ourselves, you know, in our being. And it's not that that just makes the sadness go away like that, but it changes it because you realize, oh, I was never apart from things. I never did not belong, you know? Yeah.
No, it's not a bad sadness. Like, you know, yeah. We tend to try to avoid that, but...
Maybe it just comes with being human.
Yeah.
Yes, Venus.
What's your name? I'm sorry, what's your name?
Mark,
I could certainly relate to Mark. During meditation, at some points, even here, when you read the poem, and you read it in Spanish, I know Spanish, and you're definitely right to say it does not translate the same. That part that you just mentioned about the sadness, like going, it's like my throat was trembling, and I couldn't control the tears just coming down, but it wasn't bad.
Mm.
It was almost like... like a thank you, like you're in the right place. And I wasn't sure, that's why I asked you, because I wasn't sure, am I supposed to let this moment go deep and let the tears run and let all my emotion come out? Or am I trying to do this Sazen and say, let that pass and go back to breath? So mm-hmm. I think that's where I felt a little unsure, but I felt the same thing that Mark felt.
And this is really, I feel, an important point because we could, and there are messages that say this, especially in the Zen tradition, that seem to, if not negate, at least sidestep emotion. That's too messy. Let's not deal with that. It's just clarity, you know, that kind of... penetrating insight. I've said this before, that's how I practiced for a most of my, not most, but a good chunk of my practice life was thinking that, you know, that I needed to, in a sense, transcend my emotions in order to really see things clearly. And the more I practiced, the more I realized that's just cutting out another part of myself, and that every part of me needs to come along if I'm actually going to be of benefit to myself and to anybody else. And so I think it's more contemporary writing that is in teachers who are really saying you can't negate any of it. The question is, how do you meet, how do you hold difficult emotions sometimes? How do you give voice to what you feel in a way that doesn't hurt you or other people? How do you not get thrown about, you know, by the storms of your own mind and body? And yet, how do you not ignore them? And I think that is really a question you could spend the rest of your life on. As I said to you, you know, getting quiet and even that single pointed concentration at a certain point is doable. Is bringing that into the rest of your life that can be very, very challenging, and yet it's also doable. Blue, do you want to?
So I was going to say that at lunch at work, I usually do zazen. This goes back to your question about feelings and thoughts.
Yeah.
So at lunch, I do zazen for about 30 minutes. And so it's helpful for me to go actually back to work after I do that, because I feel as if I'm in a much clearer space. And my, you know, I actually feel as if silence is a heartfulness, and it has its own kind of wisdom. And so when I stop worrying about what I'm going to say next to a person or to someone I'm supervising, then it's much more easy. It's almost as if, because I remember one instance where, you know, I had that heartfulness, I had that ease, and then I knew the instructor that I was going to talk to, and she's a very warm, compassionate, very conscientious person, and I wanted to meet her at the same place where she was coming from. And so I could do that because I had just done, you know, all this zazen. And so it actually is just clarifying. And I feel like my heart and my head are together and they're unified, and I can actually move and, you know, be a much better person in the world. And I don't know, it was almost what you're saying, meet the other person where they're at so that there's a connection there.
Yeah. Have you ever had any of you really, you know, that... It's almost a rhetorical question. You know, that experience where you know you're about to have a conversation with someone, and so you go over in your mind, blow by blow, I'm going to say this, they're going to say that, and then I'm going to say this, and then I'm going to say that, and you're just rehearsing in your mind. And then you're there. There's a conversation. And then the person is speaking, and you're anticipating, okay, now I'm going to say this, and I'm going to blow them away with my wit and my selflessness or my compassion or, you know, whatever, but you're talking to yourself about it. It's not just that the interaction is happening. You're still narrating your dialogue. And then it's over. And then you walk away, and then you start to go over it again, blow by blow. Oh, they said this. Maybe I should have said that. So you had the same, in a sense, the same conversation, which is, of course, not the same three times or five times or seven times. In a week of Sesshin, for example, you might have it 12 times, you know? And so not the opposite of that, but something you just described, a different way of entering, of meeting someone else, where you're, in one sense, trusting that silence, trusting your capacity to meet them where they are, perhaps let them tell you, you know, how the conversation needs to go. So, and it's not, certainly it's not that one is better than the other, But they certainly feel different, don't they? And so I think sometimes our nervousness or anxiety about the not tolerating silence is... And again, the impulse, I think, is very natural. You know, we want to be okay. We want the interaction to go okay. Hopefully we want to meet the other person in a good way. And sometimes it's that very... effort that keeps us from actually meeting them. You know, so how wonderful actually that you're able to do zazen in the middle of the day, in the middle of your work day, because it also weaves it, you know, in a kind of very nice, seamless way to allow that silence and that space of zazen to inform your interactions with others. Yeah. Yes, Carol.
When I was outside, I decided to kind of give my permission to let my thoughts come and go and see what happened. And, of course, I was trying to listen to the silence and all the different noises were coming, the breeze, I'm laying there. I try to open my eyes, but it's too bright, and I can still see the blue of the sky when I close it. And I remember Shugen saying to me about thoughts, you can't ever really... The mind is always thinking, but we're calming, and I like that word, calming. So even when I'm out there, I was trying to calm the mind, but still enjoy the sounds. And I heard a buzz, and I thought, oh, is that a bee? Are they already out? How cool. You know, it's flying around. I can hear the buzz, and it's going right over my face, and it's buzzing really loud, and it decides to land right here. And out loud, like the silence is gone, out loud I go, oh, no, no, not here, not now. And it went away. But
it went away.
Yeah,
it listened.
Because I yelled. But it was very nice being out there.
Was it different from your zazen?
Yes. I think it was because I was not trying to calm my mind. It just, I could let things flow. But what's interesting is whenever I breathe, you know, just when I can, let's just say I'm on an elliptical and I'm breathing hard, it's the same breath, no matter how fast, that I do when I'm calming my mind to zazen. So it's, I guess, because I'm concentrating on my breath. I'm being the breath, mm-hmm. no matter how I breathe. So it was when I was out there, I still had this sense of doing zazen just because of the breath. But mm-hmm. it was different, yeah.
There was a teacher, a Tibetan teacher. Let me see if I... Oh, it's a Dzogchen teacher. And Dzogchen is akin to our practice of Shikantaza. So Shikantaza is really an open awareness. There is no focus. You're not focusing on the breath. You're not focusing on a koan. You're not working with a question. You're really just sitting. And if anything, you could say that you're watching the stream of thoughts. You're watching awareness. You're being that awareness itself. So Dzogchen is a practice that is very similar to that. And he says, if you're practicing in order to stop your thoughts, just have someone knock you out. Or you can do it yourself. Grab an iron bar and hit yourself hard, and when you come to, hit yourself again. Your meditation name will be the meditation bar. That's one side. But then I was just rereading Dipama. I don't know if you know Dipa Ma. This one person I would have loved to meet. She was a Burmese teacher in the Vipassana tradition. She was Jack Kornfield's teacher, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein. And she was a lay practitioner. And she was said to have an incredible capacity, you know, to enter into deep, concentrated states of mind. She was also known for incredible kindness and compassion. She apparently was a very, very warm, very loving teacher, and fierce. So both sides, she encapsulated both. And so she says to Jack Kornfield, so tell me how your sitting is going. Do you have thoughts? And Jack Kornfield is thinking, do I have thoughts? I mean, I have millions of thoughts. And so he says, well, yes, I have thoughts. And she said, well, stop them. And he said, well, I can't do that. You can't do that. And he said, no, what he actually said is, well, I could, but it would take a lot of very concentrated effort. And she says, no, you just sit down and you just do it. So what about that? So here she's saying, stop thoughts. And here he's saying, well, you can't stop thoughts. What do you think of this? Ashley.
I don't know. Looking back on my experience outside now, the irony of what happened is kind of funny to me. But I'm sitting out there, and it was really challenging for me because I couldn't. There was just thoughts and thoughts and thoughts, and just like, oh, this is nice. Wonder what we're gonna eat for lunch. You know, I was really trying. Then I'm like, no, let it go, because I remember UConn yesterday was talking to me about kind of when the thoughts come to acknowledge it, allow it to be, and then let it go.
Right.
So I must have let about 100 of those kinds of thoughts just let it go. And then I'm like, oh, this is nice. Just sort of trying, actively trying to enjoy being outside. And I do, because, man, this never happens for me. I'm used to just seeing buildings upon buildings. But it was really, really challenging to stop this sort of carousel of thoughts. And then I started to think, oh, man, time must be almost up. She told us to be back at so-and-so time. I don't want to be late and then walk in late. I wonder what time it is. And so I reached into my pocket, and I found not one but two broken watches, dead batteries. And I thought, you know what? That's it. I just give up. And then I kind of relaxed a little bit because I said the watches, the batteries don't work. I don't even know where these came from. But it was kind of funny because it doesn't really matter. Because I saw everybody get up at the same time, and then I just went back with everybody else. So it's kind of funny to think about it now.
You know, it's part of why the Zendo is set up the way that it is. It's really so that you don't have to worry. So that for half an hour, you don't have to worry about the time, you don't have to worry about the temperature, you don't have to worry about what you're going to eat, yeah. What's going to happen next. You really, it is created so that you can truly take your seat and turn, and how incredibly difficult that still is, right? Because there is so much. There is so much happening. And, you know, and the reason I'm kind of pressing a little bit with this question is because, of course, the way we understand our zazen, the way we understand anything, is how we will practice, is how we will live. So if we believe, I must stop thoughts, that's how we will practice, and that's how it will feel, and that's the effect that it will have on us. If we have a different relationship with our thoughts, that will also feel differently. And so, you know, I wanted just to bring Dipama up a little bit to play devil's advocate, but she was a greatly realized meditation master. And in my sense, you know, part of what she's pointing to is that determination, determination, the aspiration, and again, the courage that this practice requires, you know, that you can't be casual about it. At the same time, it doesn't help to be uptight about it. And so one of the I find one of the most valuable, they all are, but the right effort, you know, one of the eight factors in the Eightfold Path is so important for practice because it's constantly working with that dynamic. How much do I push? How much do I try? How much do I strive? The Buddha said, this place is good for striving when he was looking for a place to sit down and basically turn to himself and realize himself. He said, this place is good for striving. There is such a thing as effort, as zeal. One of the paramitas is zeal or effort or vigor. So there clearly is something required of us. To do, to some extent, to exert. And at the same time, as Maria Jose was saying, there also has to be a profound trust in non-doing. And both are existing simultaneously. So once again, you know, we're speaking and it sounds like a dichotomy, it sounds like a duality. And yet, if you look closely, your experience of it is that both are happening. That's why I think that also the kind of like the mark of having some maturity as a human being is your capacity to have contradictory feelings and to acknowledge that you have them. At the same time, I want to do this and I don't want to. It's not but. I want to and I don't want to. I want to do Zazen because it will help me, and I don't want to. I'd rather be watching television right now. And to hold that, so there's no part of you, again, that is being left out. Because when you have the full picture, then you have more to work with. Okay, yes, it would be nice to watch this TV show, but maybe right now we'll sit. Or choosing, no, I don't want to sit tonight. I will go out with my partner. I will watch this TV show. Great. I mean, it's you, it's your life, it's your mind. You choose what it is that you're doing, but choose. So it doesn't just happen to you. Gail.
That's funny what you're talking about. Not funny, interesting. That Kate Keats, you know, the poet?
Yes.
He talks about exactly what you just said, but he called it negative capability.
Yes.
That whole,
yes.
Yeah, that rang a bell. So I tried to take that trust that you're talking about to just sort of be, like you almost like permission, just go out there and see what happens. And suddenly I closed my eyes and I started listening to just the sounds. And I heard somebody out there in the garden with compost. And then I heard the wind. And I heard, forgot one other thing. And then suddenly this image came to me. I think it was something you had said earlier that planted a seed. This enormous field. And I was in it. And I walked up to the edge of the field. And there was, you know, like a drop-off and a huge, and I just let go. Mm. And my body went like that. And it was like it was letting go of something, and I smiled. It felt so good. And then I was almost like I was flying, you know. I mean, it's fantasy, I guess, but it was none of it I planned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, part of what I want to communicate is that, you know, this is a rigorous, a disciplined practice. And the instruction is clear. You know, you focusing on your breath, you're counting your breath, you're seeing the thought, you're letting it go, and you're coming back. And because of that, sometimes it can start to feel kind of tight. And especially if you're driven, if you're, you know, if you're a sincere practitioner and you want to, you know, you do want to see yourself and you do want to let your mind quiet down, you will do what is required of you to do that. But I can't tell you the shift that it was for me. The day that I realized, wait a second, these problems, these thoughts are not a problem. They're not distracting me from my breath. They are if that's how I see them. What if I actually let them be part of the entire picture? So there's my breath. It is still the point of focus. And there's all this stuff that is happening around it. What is that? What are these things that I'm thinking about? What are these feelings that I'm having? Can I let them be included, in a sense, wrapped into the breath? My relationship with I think my mind with Zazen shifted dramatically. It was no longer about this is concentrating and this is a distraction. It was this whole thing is teaching me about me. There is something that happens when I'm able to just remain on the breath, but all of it is giving me information. So why don't I actually take it all in? You know, so that's what I was saying. It's like you have permission, you know, try. People sometimes speak of, you know, very shyly. It's like, well, you know, I don't really formally sit Zazen at home. I just sit on my porch and I look out at the forest. Great. Do that more, you know? I mean, when you come here, yes, you have to sit in the Zendo and don't move. That's part of the deal when you come here. When you're at home, this is your practice. How will you make it so that it is yours? What will you do to inspire yourself, to incite yourself to do it? If it is not sitting on the mat that is exactly like this and da-da-da-da-da, then find some other way. You know what I mean? This is your mind, and this is your body, and this is your spiritual path. And so certain things have been handed down over a couple thousand years because they help. But as I was saying to someone, it's like there's this framework, and now there's all of these hundreds upon thousands of individuals that are coming into this practice. How will you make it your practice? Right? How will you really enter it and let it teach you what it needs to teach you. How will you discover what it has to offer you? Because it's not what's in the books. It's not what we're discussing here right now. I mean, that just gives you a little bit of information, hopefully a desire, you know, to look further. But it's not the thing. Only you can really discover that, whether it's going for a walk in the woods, or it's hauling firewood, or it's sitting on a cushion like this, or it's doing something else. You are in a constant relationship both with your mind and with that it that Chris spoke of earlier, with that source, with that home. You know, this image of having wandered away from home appears really in all the religious traditions. Why is that? Right? This image of the poor wanderer who's going in search of the place that they've lost. They've lost their way, not knowing all along they have this jewel in their sleeve, not knowing that the riches are waiting for them just to come and how do you claim them? It's in the Lotus Sutra. It's in the Christianity, the prodigal child. And so this is very much a journey, I feel, of not just returning home. It's returning home, but when you do, you realize you never left. You never went anywhere. You were actually never lost. You just forgot for a little while. Somebody else out there, maybe somebody who hasn't spoken yet. Liz, were you just shifting, or did you want to say something? Yeah. Just give her a mic.
I'm happy to offer a thought, and that is in relation to what you were just speaking about. To me, it feels that the noise that we're focusing on quite a bit and what you're helping us think through today is the noise of language, which, as I understand it, helps us to create separations in a world that is much less separated and categorized than language makes it. And perhaps that's what we forget, both as individuals, as we're developing into adulthood. We forget what children know and what infants know, and what therefore what we know, because that's still part of us. We also forget what our entire species knew before it got modernized, quote unquote, to the extent that meant much of the human species has been modernized into thinking so categorically about things and not thinking more connectedly to the large cosmology that we're a part of, but separating and dividing and categorizing. So my experience of silence is pretty much a very positive experience, because for me personally it feels like I'm able to get back to a place that feels kind of familiar to me in terms of adult childhood connection, and then maybe back
kind of that the painter who said that sound imposes a narrative on you, and it's always someone else's narrative. We could say it's the cultures, or it's our families, it's the society's narrative. So let's stop there so we can go to lunch. But just think, if I want to speak in the afternoon about nutriment, the Buddha said that understanding the nature of things, wisdom, is understanding the truth of suffering, the root of suffering, the fact that it can be alleviated, that we can put an end to it, and the way to do it, the path, right? So the Four Noble Truths. It is also, and by extension, understanding the Eightfold Path, the way to actually do that. It is also understanding what this is, you know, the skandhas, the aggregates. So we chanted in the Heart Sutra today, it was the form, empty, form, conception, form, sensation, discrimination, form, sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness is one translation. So the way that this being is put together and who experiences the way that we experience, in fact, reality. And he also said it's understanding the nutriments, and there's four nutriments. So I will talk about that this afternoon, but think of, we won't be in silence for lunch, but nutriment is really what we're taking in. Right, so what we're taking in through all of our senses. And so just have that in mind, you know, as you're, you know, getting online, you know, for lunch, as you're taking the food that you will, that we will be eating together, as you have perhaps conversations with one another, if you want to go for a walk, be aware of what is it that you are taking in through your senses, what are you taking in your mind through your consciousness, right? Remember that the Zendo is always open. So at times when we're not formally sitting, if you choose to, if you want to sit, you are welcome to. So in the break after lunch, and the break at 5 o'clock, in the evening after supper, and you know, you're encouraged to do that if you want. You're encouraged. We have 250 acres of Catskill Preserve, so you're welcome, you know, to go for a walk. You know, really use, especially those of you who are returning to really busy lives and urban lives. We call this a retreat for a reason. I mean, you did have to retreat. You did have to leave your life to be here. This doesn't solve all problems. Obviously, you have to return to your life, and how do you make this connection? But since you have brought yourself here, and you are here, use the physical space that is the monastery, that are the grounds. Use the silence that perhaps is a little bit more available to you here than in Manhattan or somewhere else in your busy lives, so that you can recharge yourself, so you can garner some strength for when you need to return and do what it is that you need to do in your lives. Okay? So we'll meet back here at 2 o'clock. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.